Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa, bringing you the News Gazette today on April the 2nd, Wednesday, 2025. Today on the front page at the very top, we have a life remembered with a picture of Stan Eikenberry with the heading, He Transformed the University. From Florida. Praised as a class act and eternal optimist, former U of I president dies at age 90. By Jana Wiersema. The longest-serving leader of the University of Illinois system has passed away. 90-year-old Stan Eikenberry, U of I president and professor emeritus, died Tuesday morning at his home in Boca Grande, Florida, surrounded by family. We're so happy that he died peacefully without any pain or anguish, and he's resting comfortably now, said his son, David Eikenberry. According to the university, Stan Eikenberry became the youngest president in U of I history when he stepped into the role at age of 44 in 1979. He previously served as senior vice president at Penn State and as a professor in the Pennsylvania State Center for the Study of Higher Education. Highlights during his 16 years as president included the consolidation of the Medical Center and Chicago Circle at UIUC, the creation of the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology and the National Center for the Supercomputing Applications, and the establishment of the President's Award Program for High-Achieving Underrepresented Students. Illinois very much led the way for the nation that eventually came around to the idea of the importance of interdisciplinary collaboration and research, said Jeff Moore, former director of the Beckman Institute. Moore, who was a professor emeritus of chemistry, added that he is grateful to carry the former president's name as the Stanley O. Eikenberry Endowed Chair Emeritus. U of I President Emeritus Bob Easter likewise said that Eikenberry's leadership was transformational. He had a vision, Easter said. He was able to articulate it, and then he transformed the university. It was a much better place when he left it. It wasn't a bad place when he started, but he took it into a new age. During Eikenberry's tenure, federal funds for research nearly quadrupled, and donation grants and contracts also abounded, U of I officials said. He also led successful capital campaigns. He loved the university so much, said wife Judy Eikenberry, and he believed in people of the university, the staff that were reaching out to new frontiers with great ideas, and he loved supporting their activities. And we saw his job as to help them to do what he saw his job as someone who could help them do what they could do. Graham Grady, Eikenberry's first student trustee for the Urbana-Champaign campus, said that the president went out of his way to learn the opinions and concerns of the students. He truly cared, said Grady, now a partner at Chicago law firm Taft, Setenius and Hollister LLP. Stan believed that the voices of the students were integral to a healthy academic community and campus. State Senator Chapin Rose, a Republican from Mahomet, also served as a student trustee, both during Eikenberry's tenure and the search for his replacement. No one could succeed Stan Eikenberry, Rose said. He was a class act. I admired him greatly, and there frankly will never be another Stan Eikenberry. I know that's a cliche to say something like that, but it's true. That guy he knew where he was going. He knew where he was taking the University of Illinois. He added that Eikenberry was highly intelligent and politically savvy. 15 years after his departure, Eikenberry returned to serve as interim president of the U of I system for 6 months in 2010, following the resignation of President B. Joseph White. White, along with UIUC Chancellor Richard Herman and most of the university's trustees, stepped down following an admissions scandal. We were in the midst of a leadership vacuum that needed to be filled fast, Moore said. Eikenberry also had to reckon with a state budget crisis during this period, at times making unpopular decisions such as furloughs, layoffs, and a tuition increase. Easter, who served as interim vice president and chancellor at UIUC during this time, said that Eikenberry was always there to offer advice when he needed it. Stan was the essence of stability, taking the university through that period of time and starting a new beginning, he said. He was an eternal optimist to the core, David said, and for all the challenges that he faced, he always saw the upside in the opportunities and had an amazing ability to persevere. And there's a picture of the University of Illinois president, James Stuckel, watching as Hood is placed on President Emeritus Stanley O. Eikenberry, while he was awarded an honorary doctorate in university administration at the 2002 commencement ceremony at the Assembly Hall in Champaign. Another article on the front page with a picture of colorful campaign signs with the heading Election 2025 Going Overtime. No clear favorite in Unit 4 race. Tax hike for strides in trouble by Jeff D'Alessio. If he said it once, Aaron Ammons said it 1,000 times. Voting by mail ought to become the norm statewide. The Champaign County Clerk's cause picked up momentum locally Tuesday with 4,956 voters' mail ballots counted, up from 3,043 in the same consolidated election 4 years ago. And they're not done. I'm confident we will exceed the 2021 total turnout of the 16,394, or 13.4% of registered voters. And the increase in vote by mail is a major catalyst for that, Ammons told the News Gazette as the clock approached 10 p.m. on Tuesday. We will likely have over 2,000 more vote-by-mail ballots to process and cast over the next 2 weeks. I'm confident that VBM will grow each election and make our elections more efficient and cost-effective. With that many mail ballots still to go, many contested races remain too close to call Tuesday, with Ammons' office stressing that all results were unofficial. But with nearly 10,000 votes counted, including 3,792 early and 1,249 day of, a few trends emerged by the 10 p.m. deadline on Tuesday. If Champaign's low-barrier homeless shelter is to remain open beyond October, officials might have come up with a Plan B to fund it. For the second time in 6 months, it appeared City of Champaign Township voters were well on their way to rejecting a property tax hike to pay for the Strides shelter, with the no votes, 2,388 or 62%, outnumbering the yes crowd, which was 1,446 or 38%. In the highest-profile contested race, 11 candidates competing for 5 spots on the Champaign School Board, there was no clear favorite. 6 candidates had more than 2,400 votes, but less than 3,000 with Fatima Ahmed, the early leader of those running for 2-year seats, 2,933, and Tony Bruno out front among the 4-year seat seekers with 2,830. And there are included some pictures of people on voting day. There is a picture of Champaign School Board candidate Grace King, who was accompanied with her first-time voter son to the polls on Tuesday. And then there's a picture of Champaign School Board hopeful Tony Bruno started his election day by taking his kids, Farrell, Whittier, and Archibald, to school. There's another picture of a man on a bicycle that with a poster board that says Vote Al Molina as he's riding along, and another picture, a lone Urbana School Board candidate on the ballot. I'm not running, I am cycling, says Unit 4 School Board candidate Al Molina, and then Champaign Council incumbent Michael Fulmer, who's running unopposed, cast his vote at the Champaign Public Library. Another article on the front page from the Champaign County Courthouse by Luke Taylor with the heading, Two Taken into ICE Custody Tuesday. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers arrested two individuals at the Champaign County Courthouse on Tuesday morning. ICE officers arrived accompanied by local FBI officers and informed court security officers that they were seeking a Fernando Lorenzo Raimundo. Sheriff Dustin Howerman said his officers, including court secretary, could not help ICE find the individuals, but also were not allowed to impede ICE officers in their operations. The ICE officers ultimately arrested both Lorenzo Raimondo and another man, Carlos Gomez. State's attorney Julia Reitz said her office is not notified of ICE action in advance, and in accordance with the state law, local and state law enforcement can neither assist nor obstruct ICE. The incident was not unprecedented, nor particularly rare, said New American Welcome Center President Ricardo Diaz. Since President Donald Trump's second inauguration, ICE has visited Champaign-Urbana two other times that Diaz is aware of. He also doesn't believe these visits are more frequent than they were during the previous administration. ICE has always come. They didn't make a big deal about it before, and the problem of them coming now is that there's a context in which they've made a lot of noise nationally, Diaz said. Nationally, ICE arrests have become more frequent, though fewer individuals are being deported under the Trump administration than during Joe Biden's presidency, as reported by NBC News and the New York Times. In any case, Diaz said he is not overly concerned about these visits because they have been specific and targeted arrests, with ICE officers carrying court orders or warrants for certain individuals, rather than large-scale raids like he saw when he lived near the border. I have been at restaurants in which they do a raid. They close off all the exits, they capture everybody inside, at factories too, and then they do their tricks to get people to confess, he said. Diaz said he does not get involved in cases where an undocumented immigrant has committed a crime. He will assist their family if he can, but they generated a problem and they need to face it, whatever it may be. One of the challenges in assisting immigrants locally, Diaz said, is that very few of them have had any previous interactions with ICE and so do not know what to do if they encounter an officer. I can tell you this, the most afraid people are the ones that are not informed, he said. The New American Welcome Center provides support to immigrants, including legal assistance and training on how to be prepared to speak with ICE officers. While it's unclear whether the ICE arrests were related to charges either man arrested Tuesday was facing, both do have ongoing cases. Lorenzo Raimondo, 36, of Champaign, has been charged with failure to report an accident causing death and was in the courthouse this morning for a preliminary hearing. He was involved in a hit-and-run incident that resulted in the death of James McCammon, 58, of Champaign, on March 4th. 2 hours later, Lorenzo Raimondo arrived at the Champaign Police Department and identified himself as the driver involved. Preliminary investigations have attributed the accident to rainy conditions, causing Lorenzo Raimondo not to see the pedestrian, as he provided blood and urine samples and was not found to be impaired in any way, Reed said that week. Gomez, 45, of Urbana, has been charged with aggravated driving under the influence on a suspended or revoked license and was in the courthouse for a pretrial hearing. Reed said that her office will have to see what we do moving forward on those cases. There are still cases if somebody was hurt or we have a victim, we want to get justice for that victim, regardless of the defendant's immigration status, Reed said. Let's continue with an opinion piece by J. Mark Powell from his Holy Cow History. And it's here with a very vintage picture of an assassination attempt. The first presidential assassination attempt. After a 4-year absence, Andrew Jackson is back in the Oval Office. Not the actual Jackson, of course. After all, the iconic office didn't exist when he lived in the White House. Instead, his likeness has returned. President Donald Trump makes no secret of his admiration of the old hickory. Jackson's portrait hung there during Trump's first presidency, a loaner from the U.S. Naval Academy. President Joe Biden replaced it with a painting of Ben Franklin when he moved in. Jackson was restored along with Trump 2.0 in January, though it's a different image. Something else is different from the 2017 time as well, because presidents number 45 and 47 now shares something in common with president number 7 that he didn't during his first term. Would-be assassins marked both men for death. The bullet that grazed Trump's ear while he was speaking in Pennsylvania last July came dangerously close to robbing him of his political comeback and his life. Few people remember that Jackson almost became America's first assassinated president, and it was a very close call. It happened on January 30, 1835. A funeral for South Carolina congressmen had just wrapped up inside the U.S. Capitol, and Jackson was walking out of the East Portico. Suddenly, an unemployed painter named Richard Lawrence approached. He pulled a Derringer pistol out of his pocket and fired at point-blank range. The percussion cap did not ignite, meaning the gun didn't fire. How did Jackson respond? By bellowing, "Let me alone," and lunging at his assailant. Lawrence produced a second Derringer and pulled the trigger. It didn't fire. The 67-year-old Jackson delivered his own brand of justice by whacking the daylights out of Lawrence and his hardwood walking stick. With his stick, suddenly the attacker was in danger of becoming the victim. Lawrence was spared when a naval officer joined by U.S. Representative Davy Crockett, later of Disney's King of the Wild Frontier fame, intervened. Jackson was hustled into his carriage and rushed to the White House. He had just survived the first known assassination attempt on a sitting president. Jackson talked about it endlessly at a party that night, blaming his political rivals for trying to eliminate him. But no traces of a conspiracy ever turned up. That's because Lawrence was as crazy as the proverbial bedbug. During his trial that April, where he was defended by Francis Scott Key, author of The Star-Spangled Banner, he told jurors that he had no right to pass judgment on him. Privately, he claimed Jackson had killed his father. He also said he was English King Richard III and was entitled to payments from his American colonies, which Jackson had somehow denied him. No surprise, then, that Lawrence was found to be insane. He spent the next 26 years in a mental institution, dying there in 1861. And what about the Derringers? Why didn't they fire? Nobody knows. Both guns were later tested and worked perfectly, their bullets hitting a target 30 feet away. Experts rated the odds of both pistols not firing at 1 in 125,000. Andrew Jackson had, figuratively, dodged two bullets. He completed the final 2 years of his presidency and returned to his plantation outside Nashville, Tennessee. He died there 8 years later at age 78. At the time of his death, Jackson was precisely what he had been throughout his life and remains 180 years later, a highly controversial and divisive figure, and very nearly the first in the tragically long line of presidents gunned down, too, proving yet again the truth in Harry Truman's observation: the only new thing in life is the history you don't know. And there also is a picture. It's a portrait of former President Andrew Jackson shown in the Oval Office of the White House on January 20th, the day of President Donald Trump's second inauguration. Continuing on in our communities, in Capital News, Illinois, an article by Peter Hancock with the heading, "I do not want to go to Washington. State Attorney General Kwame Raoul rules out bid for the U.S. Senate." While many Illinois Democrats wait anxiously to hear whether U.S. Senator Dick Durbin will run for re-election in 2026 or step down after five terms in the Senate, at least one incumbent officeholder appears to be ruling himself out as a potential successor. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul said Tuesday he's not interested in running for that job or any other elected position in the foreseeable future. "I do not want to go to Washington. I want to stay here," Raoul told a luncheon audience at the City Club of Chicago. "And this is no knock on Senator Durbin or Senator Tammy Duckworth. I truly believe that I do what I do on a day-to-day basis as Attorney General has more impact than what I could do as a U.S. Senator. Durbin, who turned 80 in November, currently serves as the Democratic whip in the Senate, the second highest ranking position in the caucus, behind Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York. But he's widely expected to announce in the coming weeks whether he will run for another term, and there has been rampant speculation in political circles about who might succeed him. Raul, 60, has become the target of much of that speculation in recent months by joining numerous multi-state lawsuits that seek to block many of President Donald Trump's executive orders and other policy initiatives. Those include Trump's efforts to halt the recognition of birthright citizenship that is recognized under the 14th Amendment, to freeze the distribution of federal funds previously appropriated by Congress, to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education, and to terminate the employment of 10,000 of federal employees. But Raul, who served 15 years in the Illinois Senate before being elected Attorney General in 2018, said emphatically Tuesday he does not want to be considered for Durbin's seat, insisting he can do more to counteract the Trump administration from the Attorney General's office than from anywhere else. I know that the Attorney General's office, and it's in every state, produces more than a single U.S. senator can for its constituency, he said. So why would I leave doing something more important to doing something, I'm not saying unimportant, but less impactful? Durbin himself has come under criticism from fellow Democrats, including Governor J.B. Pritzker, for voting last month in favor of a Republican-backed spending plan that averted a partial government shutdown, but also provides for implementing massive spending cuts over the next 10 years. Pritzker called the vote a huge mistake, but Durbin defended it by telling reporters at a March 18th event in Taylorville, "I have never voted for a shutdown, and I didn't last week." In his comments Tuesday, Raul said the budget vote caused a rift within Democratic circles nationally, but he said he would not second-guess Durbin or any of the other Democrats who voted to let the spending package go through. "I don't know how I would have voted on the continuing resolution," he said, "but I'm not going to drag anybody over the coals without a very healthy, well-informed debate about everything that they were facing at that moment." Also in our communities, an article by Dave Hinton with the heading "Stars Over Champaign-Urbana: Tremendous, Dangerous, Exciting." Cunningham Children's Home CEO Marlon Livingston honored for his military service. Marlon Livingston, CEO of Cunningham Children's Home, spent a year in the Army National Guard stationed in Iraq. He received the Defense Meritorious Service Medal for his service in the Iraq War. Livingston received additional recognition of his service this week. It was draped around his shoulders. Kay Miller and Kathy Parisho representing the Quilts of Valor group Stars Over Champaign-Urbana presented him with a quilt at Cunningham Spiritual Life Center this week, just in time for the Children's Home annual Festival of Quilts on Friday and Saturday. Miller, who heads the local Quilts of Valor group, said it has been in existence for about 8 years. Stars Over CU is always looking for more area military veterans to honor. Change of career plans. A Charleston native, Livingston earned an undergraduate degree from Eastern Illinois and a master's degree in social work from the University of Illinois. "I'm a social worker by trade," Livingston said. "I had a brief stint in Florida, but was able to come back home about a year after I came back from Iraq, when Sam Banks, who had originally hired me in the early 90s, moved on from Cunningham. It was a coming home in more ways than one. Back home to the state where he grew up, and back home to an agency that first hired him. After graduating from the U of I, he was hired at Cunningham." Livingston said his service in the National Guard helped to pay for his schooling. "I was an enlisted soldier for about 4 years and had an opportunity to go to Officer's Candidate School," Livingston said. He was commissioned a second lieutenant and became a scout platoon leader in Urbana and a company commander in Danville. The unit Livingston was assigned to was not scheduled to be mobilized overseas, and he was getting ready to retire when he received a call from Army Human Resource Command in St. Louis. He was informed that he was being deployed to Iraq. That call was on Friday, Livingston said. I had my orders on Sunday. I left the next Friday for Fort Bliss and was in Kuwait the following week and in Iraq shortly after at Camp Taji. The military can move very quickly if it wants to, Livingston said. Prior to leaving, Livingston got his will updated, took family photos, and his extended family flew to Miami. He was then working in Florida. As quickly as he could say to say goodbye. Mixed bag of emotions. Livingston had the same thoughts as perhaps most personnel who are sent overseas to a military zone. He had three young sons, aged 5, 8, and 10. Some of his thoughts centered on what would happen to them if he didn't make it back. When you serve, and I don't think that's unusual, it's a mixed bag of emotions, Livingston said. I was at the end of my career. I'd never been deployed previously. You spend your entire military career training to do a job. Part of it was exciting, knowing that this was a chance to share coach and mentor, those with whom he was scheduled to work. It was tremendous, dangerous, exciting, and gut-wrenching, Livingston said. In war, you get to see the very best of humanity, and you get to see the very worst, sometimes in a 24-hour period. Livingston was embedded with the Iraqi armed forces. He lived with the Iraqis, ate with the Iraqis. There were days when he wouldn't see another coalition soldier. The base where he was stationed received mortar fire on a regular basis. There was also the threat of improvised explosive devices. Probably the closest near miss of a mortar shell was about 500 yards away while he was driving. They don't particularly shoot them well, he said. The insurgents would just shoot them randomly. You kind of went about your day hoping you'd get lucky. He was lucky that day. If the mortar had hit a little bit later, Livingston might have been among the casualties. 3 months into his deployment to Iraq, his retirement was approved. Because he was deployed forward, however, he was expected to complete his tour of duty, which ended about a year after he arrived. At Cunningham, Livingston was named CEO in 2008. The children's home is in its 130th year. We're the same, and we're changing at the same time, he said. In the beginning, the home took care of just children. Now it takes care of kids and their families. Generally speaking, when kids are connected to their family, even when what they've experienced has been very traumatic, they're going to transition better into adulthood. And there's a picture of Kay Miller and Kathy Parisho of the local Quilts of Valor group, Stars Over Champaign-Urbana, presents a quilt to Cunningham Children's Home CEO Marlon Livingston for his military service. And one last article I'll try to squeeze in here in the last few minutes of our first half of the News Gazette, an article from Urbana about the Hotel Royer. Long-awaited hotel schedules hiring events, staff being sought for all departments. While an official opening date for the long-awaited Hotel Royer has yet to be announced, there is some indication that the business may be close to making its debut. The hotel, which is located at 210 South Ray Street, has announced that it will hold a hiring event Saturday afternoon. For those who are unable to attend, interviews will be held on site from 4 to 6 p.m. on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. As we prepare to open the doors of Hotel Royer, a tapestry collection by Hilton, we are seeking dedicated professionals to help write the next chapter of this landmark storied past, the business shared on social media. Join us for our hiring event and step into a career where timeless hospitality meets modern excellence. While the Facebook event listing shows the time for the hiring event as from 1 to 5 p.m., the description states that it will take place from noon to 4 p.m. in the Grand Ballroom. Hotel Royer is hiring for all departments, including the front desk, housekeeping, food and beverage, banquets, and culinary services. The announcement comes 3 months after the development missed the Urbana City Council's latest occupancy deadline of December 31st, 2024. And that will be the end of this first half of the News Gazette. I look forward to getting started with you on the second half in just one moment.